Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic report du jour is once again about housing. The way it works is that one day the used home sales numbers come out, as they did yesterday. And then the next day, it's new homes. Anybody out there care to guess which one's more depressing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today. This one is the 23rd of June. Good to have you here. The Commerce Department reported on May sales for new homes this morning. It's a figure they have been keeping track of since 1963. I mention that date because in all the years since then, we have never seen a lower annualized new home sales number. That's mostly because people stopped shopping for homes after the government stopped offering an $8,000 tax credit to do so. Now, the housing market helped get us into this recession. And as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York, we're going to need it to help get us out.
Plenty of market watchers here in New York were floored by this morning's news. Dan Greenhouse is one of them. He's chief economic strategist at Miller Tabak. He says no less than our entire economic recovery is at stake.
Without that boost from housing, that boost from confidence, and that boost from jobs, it's very difficult to make the case that we're going to have a broad-based V-shaped recovery until the housing market fully turns, and that may not be for several quarters.
Greenhouse says the reason the housing market matters has less to do with construction jobs and interest rates and more to do with consumer sentiment.
A house is someone's largest investment, and it's very hard to argue from a sentiment standpoint that I feel comfortable going to Best Buy to buy a new TV or J.Crew to get a new whatever J.Crew sells if my single largest investment, that is my house, is going down in value every month.
So could a collapse in the housing recovery send us into a double-dip recession? I asked Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics.
If the housing market starts moving downward again, if we start seeing large, consistent price declines, that would be the basis for a double-dip recession. In fact, you know, I think the threat from housing is probably more serious than the threat that's coming from the European debt crisis.
But Zandi says this morning's news shouldn't be too surprising given the expiration of that tax credit. He expects only modest declines in home prices going forward, and that, he says, should help us avoid a double-dip recession. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said today he's going to come up with another way to get a drilling moratorium in place on the Gulf Coast. A federal judge in New Orleans threw out the administration's first pass at a six-month ban yesterday. Critics of that decision quickly discovered that the judge in the case, Martin Feldman, has held shares in a number of oil and gas firms, including Transocean, the company that owned the Deepwater Horizon rig that's at the root of the current troubles. And that got our morning meeting wondering today, what sorts of rules do federal judges have to follow when it comes to investing? Brett Neely has more.
It's usually up to judges to decide whether they have a conflict of interest in a case. There's one hard and fast financial rule, says law professor Charles Jay at Indiana University.
Were he to own even a single share of stock in one of the companies that is in the middle of the litigation, he would have to step down.
That wasn't the case in yesterday's decision. Judge Feldman didn't own shares in the companies that sued over the government's ban on offshore drilling. But his most recent financial disclosures showed that he owned shares in several energy companies, including ones that drill in the Gulf of Mexico, up to $15,000 worth of stock in each one. The judge hasn't responded to media requests for more detail.
Once you have this issue raised, I think that's the kind of basis on which judges either need to make full and complete disclosures or take themselves off the case.
Deborah Rohde teaches legal ethics at Stanford Law School. She thinks more judges ought to put their assets in a blind trust so that there aren't these perceived conflicts of interest. But law professor Jay says it's also important to look at how those stock holdings relate to a judge's overall net worth.
No reasonable person would say, were I a millionaire, the fact that my stock might drop from $15,000 to $12,000 is going to really affect my judgment.
Maybe, but at least eight of Feldman's fellow federal judges in New Orleans have recused themselves from cases related to the BP oil spill. And others have sold off their oil and gas holdings so they can hear the flood of lawsuits. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
I don't know if they are technically in a back room, but House and Senate negotiators are meeting today to hash out the last details of their financial reform bill. And that actually is no mean feat, because policymakers have been talking about financial reform since pretty much the day Lehman Brothers went under. And as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains, there is a mind-numbing number of details to hash out.
The negotiators are still wrestling with controversies, like what's a bank anyway? House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank.
We amend the definition of financial companies in the denominator of the 10% concentration limit. We think it's a better representation.
So that's cleared up. But nobody can seem to agree on Section 121 of the Senate bill, which says, this section authorizes the Board of Governors if it determines that a non-bank financial company supervised by the Board of Governors pursuant to a determination under Section 113 or a bank holding company with total consolidated assets of $50 billion or more poses a grave threat to the financial stability of the United States to require such company to comply with conditions on the conduct of certain activities, terminate certain activities, or if the Board of Governors determines that such action is inadequate to mitigate the threat to the financial stability of the United States, sell or transfer assets to unaffiliated entities. There's obviously lots of room for debate on that. Still, the negotiators plan to finish their work tomorrow so the president can sign the bill by July 4th. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
She gets a lot into 57 seconds, don't you think? The Fed wrapped up its meeting on interest rates today without doing anything. Markets did the same. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Cell phones are so much a part of our lives nowadays that there might not be too many people who think about this anymore. But there is a school of thought out there that says all those cell phone signals passing so close to your brain can't possibly be good for you, cancerous even. The actual science on that is murky, but the San Francisco Board of Supervisors isn't taking any chances. The city is set to become the first in the country to require that retailers disclose phones' radiation levels. Jan Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Cell phone companies are required to disclose how much radiation we absorb from their devices. Just not at the store, when shoppers are all excited about a phone's new features and apps. Soon, though, San Francisco retailers will have to post radiation values, known as SAR, next to a cell phone's price tag. 1.6 is the legal limit. Many smartphones are closing in on that. Debbie Raffel is with the city's Department of the Environment.
We feel like this is information that consumers might want to know when they're making their purchasing decision.
The industry argues the law will mislead buyers. Joe Gregorich is with the trade group Tech America.
It could create an opportunity where a consumer thinks the one with a lower SAR is safe when that's not the case.
There's no definitive evidence that a lower SAR value is safer. Dr. Matt Ewind is chief of neurosurgery at the University of North Carolina.
The data has been very soft, either negative or very slightly positive, but with a lot of questions about the validity of the data.
The city's position is that inconclusive science is all the more reason for disclosure. Renee Sharp is with the Environmental Working Group and helped the city craft the new law.
It's exactly in the situation where the science is not definitive and the science is not settled, so to speak, is when you need to have such right-to-know questions.
For now, San Francisco's an outlier, but the law could have wide implications for cell phone companies. Once these values are posted in stores, they're likely to go viral. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Just when you thought the BP oil leak couldn't get any worse, it has. Today, an undersea robot ran into the gear that's sending oil up to the surface to be captured, so BP had to shut down the containment system, which means the leak is basically uncontained right now. So far, more than 40,000 people have offered up their ideas for how to stop the leak and clean things up. A BP spokesman says they've gotten some good ideas that they're reviewing. They've bought some of actor Kevin Costner's oil and water separation machines, for instance. But a lot of non-celebrities aren't getting through to BP. So they're going to local governments to see if they can get anybody to pay attention. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana, is where you don't want to be during this oil spill. Unless you're an entrepreneur. Gary Palachek is parked at the parish government. His truck holds a big pump with banners on it. Oil skimming, waterproof pump stations. He's about to make an unannounced sales call.
All I want to do is find the top people to at least look at it, and if they don't like it, fine, but at least I feel like I've at least tried.
He's also got a little camper attached to the back where he's been sleeping for 2 weeks. Palachek drove 700 miles from Oklahoma, and he's not the only businessman who sees opportunity here in southern Louisiana.
We're hearing from people all over the world, actually. We're getting calls, in the United States, we're getting calls from a guy called from England. We've had people fly in.
That's Brandy Fitzgerald. She's one of two people here in the parish government offices whose full-time job is to answer calls from people with products or devices or ideas to help contain or clean up the oil spill.
They don't stop.
They get about 100 calls and visits every day. Some people with straightforward ideas, some that are a bit harder to make sense of.
Plaquemines Parish product line, Brandy speaking. How may I help you?
The man on the phone is calling from Ohio. He thinks they should consider using a weed harvester.
He told me that it picks up everything, oil, the sheen. He said it literally picks up the fish and turtles, and you have to throw them back.
Brandy's been answering calls like this for a month. She and her coworker, Tia Matthews, read emails and faxes from people with skimmers, with boom, with boats, with oil dispersants. Each one gets filed in sorted binders and then forwarded to BP. Some proposals are fully fleshed out. Others are pretty basic sketches, including one I spot in the ideas binder for a donut-shaped containment device with the handwritten instructions, make a big long sack that the oil can't leak out. Sometimes people send the product they're pitching. Tea and Brandy, show me.
Maybe
people
want to
send videos. They want to send demonstrations.
Oh, can you show me your other room of stuff?
Oh, yeah, you want to see the products, the corner of products, I was telling.
The corner of products includes bags of absorbents, something called Oil Gone Easy, and a big box labeled Ocean Mop, which seems to be a mattress cover. Brandy says she keeps an open mind. Whatever will work sounds like a good idea to her. Michael Evich doesn't have a product. He has a plan. Okay. He's waiting in the parish office to talk to someone about it.
You want to see my drawing?
Yes, please.
He has a sophisticated drawing of a Christmas tree-shaped device that helps capture and divert oil at the wellhead. He's patenting his idea.
Now, do you think this design could actually make you a wealthy man?
I didn't really think about how wealthy I would come, but I have oyster leases. I'm oysterman. And I would definitely like to see my leases surviving.
Evich says he just wants his sons and grandsons to be able to work oysters the way he has. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, more kids or more stuff?
Just because people live in rural China or lower tier cities doesn't mean that they have any less exposure to a lot of the different things that young people all over China are wanting. It's a question of, do you want to have those for yourself or are you willing to give those to your children?
But first, let's do the numbers. Major market gauges pointed in both directions at the close, which was pretty much the way things went all day. After zigging and zagging, the Dow Industrials ended up just a fraction, 4 points, closed at 10,298. The NASDAQ back down a third of 1%, 7 points, ended at 2254. The S&P 500 also dropped about a third percent. That's 3 points on that particular index, finished at 1,092. Concerns about the strength of the recovery kept the financial shares in flux. J.P. Morgan Chase gained 1.5%. Goldman Sachs also shined up about a quarter percent. But Bank of America withdrew about a percent, and Citigroup forfeited 1.25%. Continuing low interest rates sheltered home builders from May's dismal numbers we started with. KB Home shot up more than 4%. Lennar added almost as much. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for May. Those are products that typically last more than 3 years. A House committee discusses students and cyberbullying. What role can schools, parents, and communities play to keep students safe? And for the bookworms out there, the American Library Association annual conference begins in the nation's capital. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. General Stanley McChrystal had a 20-minute meeting with President Obama this morning. It's about all the time it took for the president to accept McChrystal's resignation. Those widely quoted quotes in Rolling Stone were what did the general in. The story was everywhere yesterday, online and on the air, even though the actual magazine itself isn't even out yet. That's pretty much par for the course in this digital age, and Rolling Stone is going to lose some newsstand sales, but Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports they're still going to come out ahead.
If you want to see an old-fashioned paper copy of the story, you'll have to wait until Friday, which is when it shows up on the newsstand. But the story's been online all week. It showed up there even before Rolling Stone posted on its own site. John Harrington follows publishing, distribution, and circulation. He says that means there probably won't be the kind of big jump in newsstand sales we used to see.
People, consumers, readers being able to access it online, that's where they're going to get look at that article. Few of them are going to go down and buy a copy at the newsstand.
He says newsstand sales aren't that big a deal. They only make up about 20% of revenue for magazines. But publishers do have to figure out how they're going to make money online. I mean, you can read this story about General McChrystal on Rolling Stone's website for free.
One of the big questions I think all of them are looking at is, what do you charge and how do you charge?
It's a question most publications are still struggling with. Bo Sachs is publisher of Precision Media Group, which looks at the publishing industry. He says Rolling Stone didn't plan to put its story up online quite so soon. But it doesn't matter. What matters is all the attention it's getting.
It's on everybody's tongue right now, the Rolling Stone. You can't pay for that kind of coverage. If he took an advertising campaign, he couldn't afford what he already got.
And that kind of publicity might just drive sales. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
It's economic alphanumeric soup up in Canada this week. The G8 meets tomorrow and Friday in Toronto. They will be joined by 12 of their closest friends over the weekend for the G20. Global economic recovery, Europe's financial crisis, yada, yada. You can guess what they're going to be talking about. Conservative commentator David Frum is less interested in what's actually on the agenda than the fact that there is an agenda at all.
I am speaking to you from a city under siege. No, not Kandahar, Toronto. This Canadian city's famously livable downtown is barricaded. Police patrol the streets. The train station and other public buildings are closed, all to provide security to the heads of government and finance ministers gathered here for the meetings of the G8 and G20. Sadly, or hilariously, depending on your point of view, this costly extravaganza originated as an attempt to break free from over-elaborate meetings. 35 years ago, then-French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing proposed a face-to-face get-together for the leaders of the world's big free market economies. No agenda, no resolutions, just a rare chance for human relationship building and candid, off-the-record conversation among the leaders of the world's biggest capitalist democracies. It was a good idea then. It would be a good idea now. But over the years, the meeting has grown and grown and grown. Canada and Italy joined. Seats were set for the EU and Russia. Now the G8 is merging into the G20, including India, Brazil, and China. The more the merrier. But with so many leaders taking part, an agenda becomes indispensable. If there is an agenda, there must be staffing. If there is staffing, staffers must attend. With so many attendees, the meeting would look like a failure unless it produced some kind of communique, resolution, or action plan. And with everybody expecting a communique, resolution, or action plan, the off-the-record meeting now attracts hundreds and thousands of reporters, bloggers, and assorted other media types. It is like some hideous parable of modern government. The reasonable, modest initial idea, mission escalation, cost inflation, and the final result, a gargantuan bloat that serves only its own purposes.
David Frum is the founder of Frum Forum. Next week in his regular spot, liberal commentator Robert Reich. You can find both of them on our website. It's marketplace.org. That is also where you get to tell us what you think. Click on the link that says contact. Our series on China's one-child policy this week has been about exactly that, how most couples there are limited by law for the past 30 years to having just a single child. There are some exceptions for farmers and members of some ethnic minorities, and also for an entire county in North China where parents can have more children, but they often don't. Here's our Shanghai correspondent Scott Tong with part three of his series.
The county of Yicheng could be just about anywhere in China. Pop songs drift out of small stores. Hawkers peddle cell phones. And then there's the standard-issue burger joint. 7-year-old Qing Yu Tao is inside. He's the one blowing bubbles into his Coke. Qing's an only child, but didn't have to be. Yicheng's an experimental county, where each family can have two children, not just one. But Qing's dad, Qing Yijiao, didn't want to.
The economic burden is heavy. We have to pay for weekend activities, music, art classes, dancing, tutoring.
That spending drains money from dad. He's a courier, driving a beat-up VW Jetta. The car runs fine, but he wants to trade up.
Ferraris, the Audi 8, they're all here. Mercedes, BMWs. I want one too. But if you don't have enough money and too many children, it's a problem.
Call the phenomenon keeping up with the Wangs. China market researcher Mary Bergstrom sees this a lot. The dilemma is more kids or more stuff.
Just because people live in rural China or lower tier cities doesn't mean that they have any less exposure to a lot of the different things that young people all over China are wanting. It's a question of, do you want to have those for yourself or are you willing to give those to your children?
Most parents we found in Yicheng choose to have just one child. So, have they all drunk the birth control Kool-Aid? Sociologist Cai Yong at the University of North Carolina puts it this way.
With this propaganda ongoing for 30, 40 years, basically blaming everything bad in China to its large population, people internalize this logic.
And then there's urbanization. In the last three decades, the government has allowed hundreds of millions of Chinese to move to cities to look for work. They no longer need lots of children to work on the farm. Indeed, the rural hills outside town are emptying out. Only old people are left. Among them, the mom of Qing Yijiao, our friend with the Jetta. When she was pregnant with him back in 1981, the county was still under the standard one-child policy, and she already had one.
People from the Communist Brigade said I couldn't have a second baby, but I was determined. I needed a son to work the farm.
She somehow evaded the birth police and delivered her son in the cave where they lived.
Then they penalized me. I had to pay double the price for grain.
And they confiscated the family's precious TV and sewing machine. But here's the thing. That son, conceived at great risk to be a farmer, never worked the land a day in his life. He moved to the city, where he chose the fast life, and just one child.
Honestly, I don't even know where my mom's farm plot is.
Every afternoon, Qing picks up his son at school. Most other parents, like him, leave with just one child, even though as Yicheng residents, they have special permission to have two. For decades, this official, Che Yuelian, has zealously enforced the rules that do still apply here, like local women not being allowed a first child until they're 24, or second until they're 30. She flips through some old family planning files and beams.
One year, we had to convince five women to have sterilizations, and we did a great job. Another year, every single woman with a second child gave birth after 30, according to the rules. That was our best year.
In all, this county's population has actually grown more slowly than China's as a whole. Surprising? Not to the man behind this experiment. Demographer Liang Zhongtang persuaded Beijing to try out two kids per family 25 years ago. It was his way of pushing back against the one-child policy.
Once, I looked at a woman forced onto the abortion table. Her eyes were full of fear, doubt, blame, and hate. Human reproduction is an issue the government should not interfere in.
Liang comes back regularly to Yicheng. He's something of a hero locally, and a big hit with the county's female officials. He says the data show Chinese families naturally have fewer children than they did before. So, he says, the state doesn't have to force the issue.
It shows the government could have had a looser child policy. Lower birth rates and slower population growth are inevitable results of economic development.
But his victory is a hollow one. The two-child policy never went national as he'd hoped. Here's China's family planning minister, Li Bing, speaking on state television.
Economic development is like a cake. We want to limit the consumers, the population. We must continue to maintain a stable and low birth rate.
That's just fine by parents like Qing Yi Zhou, the guy with the Jetta and the son who blows bubbles into his Coke. He and his wife would love a bigger car. But a bigger family, he says? Who needs it? In Yicheng, northern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Reporting on a touchy subject like this in a country like China can be tricky. Scott's put together an audio slideshow of the story behind the series that's on the radio. It's online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note before we go, a sidebar, if you will, to what happens when so many people are out of work for so long. The Census Bureau is out with its American Time Use Survey, literally how we spend our time. Here's the marketplace of it. While you'd think that with so many Americans having more time on their hands because of the unemployment rate, and they might turn to other, what economists call productive activities, maybe home repairs or cooking, that is apparently not true. Get ready for this. We are watching more television. We're also sleeping more. And on this Wednesday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 4 points, just a fraction percentage-wise. The Nasdaq lost 7 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points, also a third of 1%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, the end to cheap Chinese goods.
Prices just won't go down. I mean, people were kind of used to prices for those kinds of things going down year after year. And I think the reality is it's just going to be harder to do that.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.